Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimsanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Good day, everyone. This is Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is June 6th, 2012, and we're continuing on. This is show number 23, I believe, with our co-host, Dr. Adil Kasim, MD, fourth-generation homeopath, who creates these wonderful educational programs, and it's a joy to speak with him each week when he is available. So I'm going to start today. If everyone who is out there and is going to...
Hello.
We're doing the introduction, and I am so pleased to be able to hear your voice and speak with you today.
Same goes here.
It's always a joy to study
it's
together.
It's practically a month now.
Wow. Well, I wanted to tell everyone who's out there who has their Kent repertory to open up to chapter on the chest, and we are on page 824. We're going to be continuing on with our rubric by rubric study, which is so interesting to learn about. And I also have brought today a couple of quotes. And if you'll bear with me, we have one which is kind of fun by Ken Aletta. He says, "Always point your finger at the chest of the person with whom you are being photographed. You will appear dynamic, and no photo editor can crop you from the picture."
So,
we are connected. But, you know, with Photoshop today, I don't know, people can do all sorts of things.
Exactly.
Okay, I have another quote. This is from Clara Barton, who lived in 1821 to 1912. She was a pioneer American teacher, patent clerk, nurse, and humanitarian. She said, "A ball had passed between my body and the right arm which supported him, cutting through the sleeve and passing through his chest from shoulder to shoulder. There was no more to be done for him, and I left him to his rest. I have never mended that hole in my sleeve." So it's kind of sad. But she says in a metaphorical way what happened in that incident. And I think it's difficult for us to mend what has been torn from us. And,
actually, hearing this quote, I pay homage to one of my colleagues. Same age, we were there from kindergarten to now, and he expired yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
He was a pediatrician and... an Indian pediatrician working in Australia, and a very good man, a very good doctor. He suddenly collapsed. I mean, it was sudden cardiac death. Of course, he did not have a history of hypertension or diabetes or anything else, but he just suddenly collapsed. It's such a sad and a tragic news. So, once since this quote was quoted, and by Clara Barton, so it also, via the show, I would like to pay homage to my very good dear friend. His name was Dr. Rahul Bidikar.
Well, then let's keep this show as a memoriam to him, and we will continue to study together in his honor. I also have one more quote, and that is from James Tyler Kent, who is who we're reading today. He says, "Never prescribe for a chronic case when you are in a hurry. Take your time. Never give a dose of medicine until you have considered the whole case." And this is, I'm finding it on the Homeopathy World Community Facebook page, which anybody can join. So this is his statement, to take the whole case.
And how true it is. I mean, people who practice homeopathy diligently, they, I mean, it's always the psychology of a physician. How do you understand that a particular physician has matured in his practice? It's how much time he takes to give medication. A physician who is not mature enough would give prescriptions day in and day out with very great ease. Just by knowing Materia Medica, he would give the prescriptions. But a mature physician would hold on to his remedies till the last state. And only then, once he's confirmed with the prescription, the drug, and the potency to be given, and the repetition of doses, everything is confirmed, only then will the mature physician would give that, clinician would give that dose. It applies to all pathies. Why homeopathy? All pathies. Even in allopathy or in Ayurveda, a mature physician would not give drugs haphazardly and inadvertently.
Good advice. So we have to be conservative in what we do. And what Kent was speaking specifically was about chronic cases when you're not in a hurry. So when there's an emergency, then you have to think on your toes and be quicker. Okay, so do you want to get us started, or do you have another story to tell us about while you were away, something that would benefit us?
Well, I'd gone to a state called Punjab in India, and I had to inaugurate one clinic there. We started a diabetic center there, and saw a lot of patients, about 110, 120 patients I saw. And it was fun seeing out there. I was there a week for a full day, for a full week, sorry. And then we had to go to the mountains and a good vacation, and I'm back. Full year is now packed. So it was really fun seeing the patients from another state, which is quite far from the place where I live. So we had students attending the summer school, a postgraduate summer schools, and one of them requested that he wants to open up a center there. So we arranged him, and I went there. We saw patients, we educated the masses. I talked to them what homeopathy is about, how homeopathy can help in chronic disorders like cardiac diseases or metabolic disorders. Lots of people were there. We interacted, and a good scenario was created there at that place.
Good. It's wonderful when you get to travel to get refreshed and also to teach and spread the word about homeopathy. Okay, so let's see. We want to let people know that they can find you at www.homeacad.org, HOMEOACAD.org.
Yeah.
And we welcome your questions, your calls, anything that you want to talk about. We're here for you. And I don't know if we can fix all your relationships, but we can try. Go ahead.
And I would also request the readers with the audience that even if it's the question is not about the show that we're talking about, if it's of previous shows, for example, one of the patients sent us a case regarding pericardial effusion and pericarditis, which we had covered long before, or heart failure, which we had covered long before. Still, we can keep on discussing those topics. The ultimate goal is help. Ultimate goal is awareness. And if help and awareness is there for homeopathy, I'm always there available.
Okay, I'm ready to learn.
So, for the past few episodes, we have been discussing something quite different from the routine lecture series which we had got. And that is the understanding the rubrics of the chest from Ken's chapter. As far as the theory goes, I mean, the rubrics for the chest are basically, I mean, the chest involves two important organs, the heart, the breast, the aorta, the lungs. And in addition to studying the rubrics of the chest, as far as lungs are concerned, we have got respiration and cough as separate chapters. And heart, when we are studying, then apart from chest, certain rubrics are modalities also. When we are studying chest, I would like to mention that Kent has used several old terminologies which are not now used in medical parlance. For example, apathy of the nipples. Now, this word you will not hear when doctors speak amongst themselves. Or cardiac croup. Croup is a rubric, C-R-O-U-P. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's croup. Gangrene of the lungs. Now, gangrene of the lungs, you don't get. The terminology is different. When we come to G, gangrene, I will go on and specific. Then dropsy, gouty heart, fungus hematodes, hepatization for pneumonia. All these are very old terminologies, although they are given in Kent's repertory. So what we use nowadays has to be known. Secondly, Kent also has given certain incomplete rubrics. So those incomplete rubrics make them meaningless. Actually, you can't use them clinically. For example, cyanosis. For example, convulsions. For example, paralysis of the heart. These rubrics are there in the repertory, but are they clinically to be used? It's a question mark. Then, Kent has given general rubric, like affections of the heart. For example, page 853. Now, it's such a big group, the rubric is so many drugs that you can't use it clinically. Likewise, so these are certain problems when we use rubrics from Kent's repertory. Although they are there in other repertories as well, the same problems are there. But then when you use the repertory, clinical usage is something different. And so many rubrics are given which unfortunately cannot be used. But still, understanding of those rubrics and how much can we use them clinically is the reason why we are taking this entire scenario or lectures.
Very good. Last people shouldn't hesitate to write inside their book to add the notes.
Yeah, because you can't take things ad verbatim always. You have to read between the lines. Some rubrics are given, some rubrics have to be extrapolated and used. So that's why we are discussing rubric after rubric. We are not particularly discussing about sensations. Like there are two types of sensations, sensation as if. Now, sensation as if is a delusion. Sensation is flying in the air. It's a delusion. So they cannot. There is no point in discussing them. It can be any and every sensation. Likewise, sensation of. Huge sensation of, like pain. Pain is a huge sensation of. So these two sensations are not to be discussed when we are discussing rubrics, particularly in the show, because it takes a lot of time. And there's no concrete explanations why these sensations occur. But then other rubrics, which can be used clinically, the pathological rubrics which can be used, we are going to discuss one by one as they come. So we have finished, we started with C, and C was cancer. And inadvertently actually, a full episode was dedicated only to cancer. Explanation of what cancer, what neoplasm is, it covers psychotic miasm. So now we have to move forward from cancer of the axilla, cancer of the clavicles, cancer of the mammae, to capillary network. Now, capillary network is actually what in clinical parlance again we term as hemangiomas. Hem means blood, hemangio means blood vessels, and a collection of blood vessels is called hemangioma. So there are three types of hemangiomas. We can have a capillary type of hemangiomas, which is capillary network, which is seen on the chest. It can be seen anywhere. It can be seen on the body also. Second, we can have a cavernous hemangioma. Cavernous hemangioma is a venous hemangioma. It's a collection of blood and it can be seen anywhere in the body. So these two types of hemangiomas, of which capillary hemangiomas, both are benign. They're not cancerous. They're just collection of blood vessels, many times congenital. And luckily, capillary hemangiomas also regress in size over a period of few years. Generally, you can see them on babies. They're called strawberry hemangiomas. And as the baby grows into adulthood, slowly and steadily, the hemangioma regresses. We have got certain remedies. Of course, only one remedy, Carbovege, is given here. But other wonderful remedies are Viperra and scrotalis horridus. These remedies also help to regress capillary hemangioma. But of course, they're for cosmetic purposes. You generally don't need to give medications for capillary hemangioma on the skin because they're generally benign. Hello?
Hello, I'm sorry. There was somebody else on the line, and I was simply checking to see who it was. It was a lot of people who are coming new to the show do not realize they don't have to call in. All they need to do is listen on the main Blog Talk Radio page, and then they just have to put their sound on. And there's a chat there, too. I'm sorry. Yeah. I was away for just a moment.
So...
Okay.
So we had also discussed about capillary network. Hemangiomas also we had taken last time. Moving forward, we also have covered caries of the clavicle. Caries, basically, Kent has used the word caries umpteen number of times in many chapters. What he means by caries, basically means necrosis, degeneration. And the reason why he's used caries is tuberculosis. Tuberculosis can occur in bones. And here, caries of the clavicles means caries occurring around the clavicles or inside the clavicles, which is very much possible. And the drug is Silicia. Yes, a wonderful remedy, although given in 1 mark. Caries of the sternum, yes, another very common area for tuberculosis of the bones to occur. Now, since we are talking about caries and talking about tuberculosis, I have already said this in previous show, and I'm repeating again. Thing about vaccination, which I strongly believe. Let's talk about India, because I belong to India, and let me give an example of vaccination, particularly regarding to tuberculosis. Somewhere in 1970s, say 71, 72, or 73, the government of India decided that two diseases, tuberculosis and malaria, should be eradicated. A very good thought, fine. Leave apart malaria, let's talk about tuberculosis. So they introduced for tuberculosis different centers, and every person, just newborn babies, they had to be BCG vaccination was made compulsory. Again, a good move on that part, fine. The intention was clear that tuberculosis need to be eradicated. So this suppose they had implemented in, say, 1974. And initially, before 1974, the remedy for tuberculosis in allopathy was PAS, P-A-S, para-aminosalicylic acid, granules. You have to take a teaspoonful of granules 3 times a day, and for 3 months, and your tuberculosis was cured. Initially, we used to get only pulmonary tuberculosis in India. From 1974 to 84, the number, the quantum of tuberculosis cases drastically reduced. So that was a welcome move. But then, whosoever had got tuberculosis, they did not respond to PAS therapy. That was quite astonishing. In spite of the BCG vaccination given randomly, I mean, every new person, and then the government opened separate centers called DOTS centers where you could get free anti-tuberculosis treatment. But the sorry part was, in these 10-year decade, 74 to 84, the quantum did decrease of pulmonary tuberculosis, but now the patients had to have 4 drugs instead of 1. So para-aminosalicylic acid became redundant, and you have to use INH, rifampicin, ethambutol, and streptomycin injections. That was a very sorry part. Secondly, PAS therapy, the para-aminosalicylic acid therapy before vaccination schedule began, was only used for 3 months. But now, the 4-drug regime had to be used for at least 9 months. So, again, a question mark, whether BCG vaccination did work or did not work. Fine. 84 to 94, another turn could be seen. We are talking about tuberculosis, caries. Another turn could be seen. Initially, we had lots and lots of pulmonary tuberculosis. But now, slowly and steadily, we started having patients complaining of severe backache. And when they did an MRI or a CT scan or an X-ray, they found out tuberculosis of the spine. Many people could not conceive 3, 4, 5, 7 years of marriage. They were told that they had got primary sterility or the tubes were blocked, fallopian tubes were blocked because of tuberculosis. Or they had got endometrial tuberculosis, the females. So basically what I wanted to say was, the tuberculosis had left its original place of infection, that is lungs, and became extra-pulmonary tuberculosis. So in the next decade, 84 to 94, we had lots and lots of patients suffering from extra-pulmonary tuberculosis. So 74 to 84, single drug to four drugs, and from 84 to 94, from single site to multiple sites. Fine. Now from 94 to 2004, with the advent of HIV, tuberculosis took a new turn. Initially, the basic test for tuberculosis in India was sputum. If you cough up a sputum, you could test it, and you can the bacteria is called acid fast bacteria, AFB. So you give sputum for AFB staining, and you could find out that AFB was positive. That means you could see the bacteria in the sputum. But from 94 to 2004, even if the sputum was out, we could not trace bacteria. So, but then another investigation came was TB-IgG, that is tuberculosis immunoglobulin, IgG and IgM. So this disease, which was a simple infectious disease, now has become an antigen-antibody disease. It's actually an evolution of miasm. A psoriatic disease has come to a psychotic disease. A simple curable disease has evolved into an incurable disease. And from 94 to 2004, the drug of choice, apart from these four drugs, is also steroids. Steroids were never known to be used in tuberculosis. From 2004 to 2012, the disease scenario for tuberculosis, the quantum of tuberculosis again has increased number of cases throughout India and in the Indian subcontinent. And today we have not only have pulmonary tuberculosis, but we have got multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. So now these four drugs also don't act, and the entire allopathic fraternity is left high and dry. What to do with this advancing number of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, in spite of the fact that every single child who is born is compulsorily given BCG at birth? So, since we are talking about caries of the spine and caries of the clavicle tuberculosis, we need to think as a community that is the advice of BCG vaccinations at birth in us, okay, people who have taken, we cannot say them, but in our children, is it advisable? Let us see the entire scenario of these four decades, 74, 84, 94 to 2004. And let us learn, let us question the theory whether BCG vaccination should be given. And let us extrapolate this to the entire thing, whether measles vaccine should be given or shouldn't be given, whether chickenpox vaccine should be given or shouldn't be given. So I don't say for and against, but I'm just a thought in the mind of the viewers and audience that tomorrow if I have a child, and if I have to give, for example, I have not given, luckily I have not taken those vaccinations. My father and mother did not allow them, and I'm perfectly and totally healthy. Same goes with my children too. I've got two lovely kids, and both are not vaccinated for any of these vaccinations, but homeopathically they are vaccinated. Now, turning on to homeopathic vaccinations, yes, we have lovely homeopathic remedies. Tuberculinum, for example, it acts itself as a vaccination, and a single dose is required with hardly any repetitions. So the audience should need to think homeopathic vaccination or allopathic vaccination. The ball is in your court.
Right. So every single time we put on our show, it's purely educational, and you must seek professional care and make your own decisions. This is why I am constantly fighting for health freedom, because all over the world, in all nations, especially in the United States, many of our rights to decide as a parent, as a guardian, whether or not to vaccinate is coming under the control of government. And therefore, we are not able to make a decision based on the facts at hand, which you have just given us a perfectly good history of the development of a disease and how it has become more virulent, more widespread in the body, and more difficult to find a cure. But hopefully you're going to teach us more about homeopathy and what steps we can take in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. And now, same thing is happening throughout India and other countries as well. We are losing the rights. For example, the moment my child is in the school, they ask for the vaccination shot. So sometimes you have to forge. But then that's a bad thing. I mean, we should have the rights, and we should be able to, as parents, we need to be executing our rights for our children. Because what we have to see the entire scenario. Starting a concept is very, conceptualizing a particular thing is very good. For example, every government wants a particular disease to be eradicated. That's a fine concept. But now you have 4 decades. You have to see whether really the thing which you had conceptualized, that eradication of tuberculosis or eradication of malaria, both are very much prevalent. But the problem is they are not only prevalent today as they were about 40 years ago, they have evolved into something which is now becoming unmanageable. Every single time we need to have more and more different drugs. Why? And initially a single drug could control and cure that particular disorder. Now we require 5-7 drugs, and in spite of that we are helpless. So it is time. And even and on this show, parents, so government people also, they also have children. So when they are deciding policies, they should keep in mind, it is not about allopathy or homeopathy. It is about generation next. The gen next, they may be highly intelligent and very good techno savvy, but what about their immune status? Is it still as similar to the generation before them? I don't think so.
This is what boggles my mind, that those people who are in influential and control of making decisions for the rest of the people, they're making decisions on their own family, their own children, and the future generations. But the thing is that they are not hearing the message that you're giving. They're not looking at the totality. Is exactly what Kent sent at the beginning of the show, that they're, especially in a chronic disease, that it's not an emergency, that you don't have to shoot somebody in the arm or wherever to protect them, but you have to look carefully at the totality of the case and see the history, that we're not moving in the correct direction, that we're past the antibiotic era. We're into the era of superbugs and resistance, and we have to live in harmony with nature. During Kent's time, he used quinine for malaria, and it worked. I assume it worked. And now, I don't know, would it still work?
No, I mean, that same drug has been remodified, resynthesized, and now we have got sub molecules of that quinine, and we have got lots of cases who are resistant to malaria. If initially, for example, malaria was very typical, you should have a typical fever with chills and rigors, and you should have taken the blood at 12 o'clock at night, because at that time, in the cooler parts of the night, the malarial parasite, you should come out in the blood. So that was a time when you used to take the blood for a peripheral smear of the malarial parasite. But now, even if you test malarial parasite out of 100 person, 99 become negative for malaria. And still they have got all the features of malaria. So what you do, the investigation of choice has become malarial antigen. So that simple infectious disease, because infectious has gone now to autoimmune disease. It's an antigen-antibody disease. Antigen-antibody diseases are much difficult to cure and take care of, rather than simple infectious disease. In an infectious disease, you don't have to kill the infectious organism. But now, the entire body is remodeled, and your own antigen and antibody are fighting in between. So what do? You have actually complicated the disease.
So allopathy does not really have this mindset.
No, they are talking in every seminar of infectious diseases and all, they are talking. Now they have come up with this idea. And that is why they are questioning the entire reason. This entire episode, which I told you, the entire story, was related by none other than one of the very renowned statistician and professor of preventive and social medicine, and one of the lecture series held in the local conferences. He brought up this, and none of us knew these facts so vividly well. We all knew that clinically we see that number of tuberculosis patients and malarial patients are rising, and they're quite difficult to manage. But then this fact, from 74 to 84, 84 to 94, 94 to 2004, this scenario is not what I am saying. It's people, and particularly allopaths, they have come up and they are now questioning the idea, very idea, whether they should propagate such things like vaccinations, inadvertent vaccinations. They are now coming to individualized therapy also, whether this person of malaria requires antiviral drugs, tailor-made doses, tailor-made drugs. So now they are somewhat following what homeopathy has been advocating since past 200 years.
Yes. You know, when a person, an individual, gets hit over the head or comes up against a wall or gets really, really sick, you know, the Creator has said, you have to change what you're doing. And then they stop, you know, all of this stuff, and they have to focus on healing and getting well. Maybe that's what allopathy is doing now, that they've come up against the wall. Yes.
I'm so happy. You know, there are times when my colleagues, they hit a roadblock. I mean, in spite of giving all the antibiotics or for the anti-malarials, they can't, and the patient is being hospitalized for days in and out. The bill is increasing. So they tend to call me, Adil, do you have something in homeopathy? Can you help us? So now this has become a very, very frequent thing. Initially, about, say, 10 years ago, I hardly ever used to get a call from an allopath, my colleague, although they knew, everyone was new, knowing that I homeopathy. But now they actually call me, and daily in and out, I go to different hospitals, of which even I'm not attached. I advise them on homeopathy, and we get very good, wonderful results. So it's really what is required. Now, allopathy is actually opening up to other pathies and realizing the fact that no system of medicine is complete. What is final is the patient. If the patient is happy, everyone is happy, because doctor is only meant for the patient, not for his, or for their own egos.
That's beautiful. So your successes are breeding more successes in various areas of medicine when your patient's walking out with a big smile on their face and getting well. It's proof positive that homeopathy
That's all
works.
What we have done. We have toiled so many years of our education for seeing that single smile on the patient. If I am not able to do, however degrees I have got, however good I may be, it's useless. My patient should get well. If I can make him or her well, fine. If I cannot, if I know someone who can make it, if I know some pathy if I can make it, then it's my duty to tell the patient, please go and do it. So this scenario has actually cropped up, for example, place where I live, and many, many referrals I actually get from my patients, from my colleagues, from very senior doctors, my own teachers, who about 10 to 20 years ago used to ridicule homeopathy. They used to say, hey, they are just sugar pills. And today, they actually call me, they see the results themselves. And they were asking, many people ask me about evidence-based homeopathy. I said, in your own hospital, I'm giving patients your remedy, and I don't give them from my side. I just write the name, they have to buy it, and they have to give it. And the patient is in such a controlled scenario. So, this is nothing but evidence-based. See, you have evidence, you have got ECGs, you have all other investigations you want to do. And when your patient gets well, I don't need to give any other evidence. It's, I mean, their own case, getting well with homeopathy, and they have known it. So once a person, when allopath sees actually the patient getting well, and in an acute scenario, forget about chronic scenario, but in acute scenario, I think no much evidence is required for me to prove that homeopathy acts.
Right, because it's immediate, right before their eyes. So let's go to the catarrh, which has got many, many remedies under it, and maybe explain to the folks who are new to homeopathy why some of them are in black letters, some of them are italicized, and some of them are just plain font.
Okay. Now, catarrh. Catarrh basically means discharge, and a discharge means excessive discharge. So, for example, you have got a cough. Now, the cough can be two types. You can have a dry cough, that means no sputum expectoration, or you can have a wet cough. The wet cough can be of different types. You can take out plain water. I mean, along with the cough, you can not vomit, but expectorate out watery mucus. So that is called as serous discharge, which is typically there with dal kamara. Now, suppose this type of person, for example, a person of pneumonia who's developed pneumonia, he or she starts coughing out, and with every cough has lots of copious watery expectoration. then, and if it's generally because of the exposure of damp, wet weather, onset of monsoons, or exposure to wet winds, then the drug of choice would be Dulcamara, and that's why it's given in black. But the Dulcamara expectoration or catarrh is watery in nature. Same goes with Rustox, but Rustox is not given in black letters, it is given in italics. So first is Dulcamara. If it doesn't act, then it's Rustox. Then if this discharge becomes slightly yellowish in nature, that means there is presence of bacteria or infections in this expectoration. Yellowish, not yellow, but yellowish, then the drug would be Hipparsulf. Suppose if it's a long-standing expectoration, for example, a person has been suffering from tuberculosis of, say, malignancy of the lung, cancer of the lung, and after 2 or 3 months, person has expectoration, but the expectoration is perfectly dry. And dry means it is thick and it is in the form of strings. Then we have got bichrome. Suppose if the expectoration is thick and green in color, then we have got pulsatilla. Same goes with silicea. Suppose if the expectoration is watery, it is copious, and it contains blood, then we have got sanguinaria, we have got phosphorus. If it's bright red blood, then it is called hemoptysis, and the drug of choice would be phosphorus. If it is in clots, small clots, then it is sanguinaria. If the person has got a lot of congestion, lot of copious cough, high grade fever, not responding to any drugs, then it is lycopodium. After a period of time, this catarrh, slowly and steadily, the quantum of catarrh decreases. That means the copiousness decreases of the expectoration, but still the cough is there, still the catarrh is there. And the voice starts changing. And the person coughs this way. You can hear the metallic sound. And after that expectorates out, then it is spongia, even stanum met. And finally, if none of the remedies are responding, then it is tuberculinum. But tuberculinum is not to be given. It's a caution not to be given in catarrh or cough and catarrh related to cardiac conditions. Many times, patients may not have pneumonia because of lung conditions, can have pneumonia because of cardiac conditions. For example, heart failure. In heart failure also, you can get pneumonia. And at that time, you can again have cough with bronchial catarrh or bronchial expectoration, which is copious. At that time, strictly, in Kent is written that tuberculinum should be withheld. It causes a great aggravation, which is called killer aggravation. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Okay, yeah. So this has been wonderful. I've been taking notes and going through, you went through each of the major black letter remedies and helped us to understand how to differentiate between the different kind of cough. And I especially liked your example when you coughed for us so we could hear what it is. I once, probably 10 years ago, bought a tape of someone who went through all different coughs and then what the remedies were related to that quality of the cough, how it sounded. So do you use that as something that helps you to decide?
Yeah, even I have got that tape, and we have actually recorded different types of cough in different patients, and it helps us, our students, to understand, because there are so many times when you can read a particular thing but can't explain. But once you listen to a particular thing, particular sound, then it goes inside your mind. And, for example, the cough of Rumex, cough of Drosera, cough of Spongia, they're very characteristic cough. You only have to hear them once and you know the drug is Spongia. You have, like, drug is phosphorus. So sometimes there are many, many drugs or many times a diagnosis can be made only by hearing or seeing. Same with goes with examination, the physical examination. So even I have got murmurs. There are different types of murmurs, cardiac murmurs. And different cardiac murmurs have got different medications. So likewise with cough and catarrh. Now there is an interesting rubric, alternating with diarrhea. Now you sometimes may get a viral infection which affects both the lung as well as the gastrointestinal tract. and therefore the drug is Senega, wonderful remedy. And initially, I mean, earlier days, we used to get poliomyelitis. Poliomyelitis does affect both the gastrointestinal system as well as the lungs and respiratory tract. And that condition, person tends to get loose motions and it alternates with bronchial catarrh. So Senega is a very good drug for that. Similarly, in other conditions like Borrelia, it's a different type of bacteria. You can get conditions where both are there. Fungal infections in patients of HIV, when the immunity is very low, or patients with long-term steroids, immunity is quite low. You tend to have bronchial catarrh with GIT, and both can be copious. In such situations, many people tend to give arsenic, but arsenic becomes very high. It's not always the drug of choice. So it's better to give Senega to be on the safe side and control. So this is quite a frequent symptom. Catarrh, bronchial catarrh, alternating with diarrhea in HIV patients. Very, very frequent you can get. Then we have got old people, catarrh old people in. A very common condition again, which in allopathy or in modern medicine, the diagnosis is chronic obstructive airway disease. For years together, 10 years, 20 years, 25 years, old smokers, people who have been consuming tobacco for a long time, every single year, every winter, they start having cough. And with every cough, the cough starts initially as a dry cough and ends with bronchial catarrh. Now, the catarrh can be initially watery, can become purulent, and so on and so forth. And these people, moment the weather becomes all right, it becomes sunny and dry, slowly and steadily, the bronchial catarrh goes away, but the cough remains, decreases in intensity. So for breaking this cycle, excellent remedies, again, Senega and Baraitacarb. But Baraitacarb is used when the patient does not have an active episode of cough and bronchial catarrh, whereas Senega should be used when there's an active episode, acute ongoing episode. For example, in winter, an old man of 84 years having chronic obstructive airway disease should be given Senega to control that episode instead of antibiotics. And Baraitacarb can be given to that same gentleman if in, say, May or June, when the weather is all right, cough is there, but once in a while, and the catarrh is no longer there. So Baraitacarb and Senega both are given in 3 marks, black letters. But the usage, Baraitacarb is a very deep-acting drug, and it has the potentiality to break the cycle of this repetitive cough and cold phenomena. Whereas Senega is a partially proved remedy, a smaller remedy to be used in acute conditions only.
Would this be the same as emphysema?
Yeah. Emphysema is a type of chronic obstructive airway disease. Now, there are two types of COPDs. One is chronic bronchitis, where the patient, the figure of the patient is short, stocky, and the patient is quite bulky. And these people tend to have episodes of bronchitis and bronchial catarrh every year in and out. And particularly what I described in winter months, or if they go to high altitudes, they perpetually have got a great amount of cough with expectoration. On the other hand, emphysema is the other counterpart, wherein the patients start losing weight and emaciation. And the lung also, the lung is basically made of many multiple alveoli. So these alveoli start fuse. They are individual balloons. And these individual balloons now merge to become a big balloon in emphysema. And basically, emphysema is not a clinical pathological diagnosis. And chronic bronchitis at least is amenable to cure. But emphysema, once sets in, is incurable. In this, the patient becomes quite thin, loses weight, and there's a perpetual ongoing cough with copious expectoration phenomena. They become very thin-chested. Even their heart on X-ray appears tubular in nature, tube-like. I mean, it's, normally the heart should have a particular shape, heart-shaped heart, which is not found in emphysematous patient. There's a separate rubric emphysema given here, and the heart appears tubular-shaped. But these people don't get cured, and for years together they keep on suffering, and they would prefer to be in a warmer environment. But even in warm environment, they keep on coughing and take out expectoration. And in these people, hemoptysis is very frequent, and they actually take out expectoration of pus, of blood, of necrotic tissues. So emphysema is a greater suffering than chronic bronchitis, but both are actually chronic obstructive airway disease.
Okay. Are we going to continue? It says cease.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a sensation, so we'll not be sensation as if, so we are not going to discuss about sensations because there is no base to discuss about sensations. You can have any and every type of sensation. It's a delusion. Then
okay.
Chill begins in chest. Now, chill begins in chest is a very common rubric, but here we are not going to discuss common rubrics. We are this the importance of this, we generally see in patients like septicemia. Septicemic patients or patients having pyelonephritis. Pyelonephritis means pus in the kidneys, infections of the kidneys, or urinary tract infections. Now, if you have a urinary tract infection and a patient characteristically says that, doc, initially I feel shivering inside and around my chest and then it gets generalized. So then this is a very, very important rubric. Chill begins in chest. Or you have to see chill. It's on page number 1263. 1263 page, you can see chapter of chill. Chill begins in chest. There you find the rubrics, the drugs for this rubric. But this rubric is important because of the fact that many people do come and tell us that we don't get generalized chill, say even in malaria. I would expect that if it's a constitutional, disease in the blood, then or infection in the blood, then you should start getting, entire body should be chilling. Why should particular areas of the body should be chilled? Now, because it's an uncommon symptom, that's why we can use this rubric clinically. Chill begins in chest. It may remain focused to the chest, localized to the chest. For example, in standard med. A standard med patient would particularly complain that, sir, as soon as I start getting infections, I only get chilliness and emptiness sensation inside and around the chest. It does not go near the head, nor the back, nor down. It's localized. I have to cover my chest completely. That is a particular symptom of standard metallicum. But many drugs would say that the chill may start in the chest, may go down on the legs and thighs, or may go behind on the back, or may rise up. For example, gelsemium. Gelsemium will complain that the chill starts in the chest and ascends up the spine. So this rubric, chills begins in chest, should not be ignored. It is a very helpful rubric clinically.
Okay. So are we going to...
Yeah.
I did write 1263 in my book where it says chill begins in chest, and that takes you to the section where the other part of the chapter, chill. Okay.
Is it there?
Yes. Yes, I was just telling the folks out there, I wrote the number of the page so that it would have the reference right there. Okay. So now are you doing chilliness in, or you're finished with that?
The same. Chill begins in chest and chilliness. So chilliness in the evening, chilliness after stool, chilliness open air, chilliness in alumina, arsenic, natrium carb. It's a big rubric not to be used clinically. Then we shift on to cicatrices. Cicatrices means scars. And scars, yes, we have certain remedies like graphitis and phytolaca, which help to decrease scar size. And this we have seen clinically umpteen number of times. Many times a patient who has a heart disease, for example, angina pectoris, he or she may have a heart attack and they're advised as to go and undergo bypass surgery. Bypass surgery, they say, doc, my symptoms of heart have totally gone. But one thing is constantly troubling me. And you ask them, what is the thing which is troubling you? And they said, the place where they did my surgery, I've started developing certain, the scar tissue actually pains. Now, this scar tissue is actually paining. In medical terms, it may call as a keloid. Or healing which is not in improper healing. In early stages, if you give these drugs like graphitis or phytolaca, then you can actually not only decrease the pain or that troublesome feature of that scar, but you can actually help to dissolve scars also. Certain drugs which are not given here, I would like to mention, they're not given in Ken's repertory, but they're given in other repertories. And one of the drugs is acetic acid. It's not given here.
And that is for keloid also?
Yeah. Say any scars or any scars resulting because of mal healing. See, scar is basically healed tissue, but mal healed tissue. You can have acetic acid, you can have silicea, you can have graphitis, and you can have phytolacca. Of course, silicea is given, but in cicatrices which are suppurating. Now, cicatrices suppurating, you can get particularly in fractures. For example, a person who has sustained a fracture in the chest, and even in spite of the entire therapy is finished off, your immobilization is over, 6 weeks have passed, and from one particular place, you have a scar, you develop a scar, stitches, and from that place, suppuration is there. Silicea is the drug. It definitely stops suppuration. It definitely heals the scar. It makes it plain. Now, whether the normal skin can come or not is a question of debate. It depends upon individualization. But as for myself, I have seen a number of cases, not one, two, not, but many cases, wherein the scar tissues, the size have decreased. They have the entire scar tissues have gone off. So, you cannot claim actually that in all cases, but in many cases, these remedies, particularly graphitis and phytolacca and silicea, they do help.
And what about old scars? Will these drugs work for that also?
Yeah, no, not necessarily. I mean, not old scars. In old scars, two other remedies, causticum and acid fluoride, has to be thought of. Causticum particularly, it has a tendency to decrease old scars, the size of the scars, they decrease, definitely. But it has to be given a long period of time. For example, here in fresh scars, you need to give silicea, say, I would give silicea in low potency starting from 30, and I would repeat every week, say for about a month or so, in one or two doses. Same way with grows with graphitis. But as far as if I have to give for old scars, say causticum or acid fluoride, either or, I would give in millisimal potencies, 0/1, and keep on repeating till the scar actually vanishes. So you can't keep on giving causticum 30 or 200 or 1 m for years together or months together till the scar actually regresses in size. So that's the problem with old scars. But yes, causticum or acid fluoride, either or, does take care of those old scars as well.
Excellent. Okay.
Then we have got clawing sensation. We'll not be discussing clothing aggravates. Now, clothing aggravation is basically a physical general, and it's quite individualistic. It pertains only to homeopathy, and that is why we have got certain drugs like lachesis. Many people don't know that even in causticum, a causticum patient does not like much clothing in and around, especially not tight clothing, which also goes with lachesis. And apis, and I'm so sorry that apis is not given here, but apis is another remedy which hates clothing in and around the neck and the chest, and always wears loose clothes. So lachesis, 3 marks is given here, black, but apis is not mentioned at all. Apis should be added, and apis cannot tolerate tight clothing. Apis also cannot tolerate tight clothing around the chest. It becomes very difficult in patients of lachesis and apis if they sustain an injury and you have to actually wrap up the chest. For example, in certain situations, we have to actually immobilize the chest. So in these patients, they absolutely would not be able to tolerate, and they would be highly irritable till the wrapping around is there. They don't even tolerate bandages, such is the problem. And to reduce the sensitivity, you need to give one or two doses of lachesis or apis. After that, they can tolerate the bandages or tight clothing around it. So the sensation definitely decreases, although it may not go completely in toto, but it definitely decreases and helps the physician or the attending doctor to immobilize the chest wherever is required, or if the tight clothing has to be put for some reason, then it is helpful.
Right. So you've mentioned two of the black letter, causticum lachesis, and you added apis, but there are still many other smaller remedies there.
Yeah, but for example, chelidonium and kalibine. Chelidonium clothing would aggravate only when the person is particularly having, say, gallstones. If I have a gallstone and many patients, for example, a patient of Bryonia, or for that matter, a patient of Berberis, would like something around my abdomen and chest. It's a gallstone. I would like some pressure. But if I hate pressure, I don't dislike pressure, at that time, in the clothes, then it is indication. See, there are many remedies for gallstones. One is berberis, other is chelidonium, third is chemophilia, bryonia. All these drugs actually act and decrease the size of the gallstones. Many have the potentialities of expelling the gallstones and making them, or decreasing the size and making them into sands. But the symptomatology, how a particular thing is to be selected, this simple, small rubric, clothing aggravates, chelidonium. Very, very few people, I'm sure not many people know that chelidonium also has this rubric. But then, yes, it is only in a particular scenario or particular situation. Only the right side, it hits whenever there's a pathology inside. Lachesis on, or apis, on the other hand, it's a general rubric. Even if they don't have any disease, they would dislike clothing in general. So it becomes a very, very important rubric constitutionally for lachesis and apis patients. But for pathologicals or symptomatic, it is for smaller remedies like chelidonium, or for that matter, tarantula or lycopus.
Can I ask a question about the lachesis? Because I understand that the snake remedy, we don't have a lot of other snake remedies listed there. Would another snake remedy possibly be appropriate for this remedy, for this rubric, clothing aggravates?
Like which one?
Any of them, elaps?
No.
Or
no. No, none of the remedies. None of the remedies have got this particular symptom, which is 3 marks in lachesis, because lachesis is extremely important. It is a physical general. It's a symptom which individualizes lachesis patient in toto. Lachesis patient is quite sensitive to anything around him or her. No other snake disease has got this symptom, and it should be very particular and proven. And in proving of lachesis, carried or anywhere, this symptom has come out quite prominent, both in lachesis and apis. Apis, of course, become, both are hot patients, so both would not like much clothing. But then the characteristic of both these drugs, they, if given a choice, would not wear clothing at all, which is not there with other remedies. So other snake remedies do not have this symptom at all. Crotalis horridus or Vipera or Crotalis cascavella, Cobra, none of these remedies have this symptom, apart from lachesis.
Thank you for answering. That was a good answer. Okay.
Then we have got clucking sound. Now, again, clucking sound, very debatable rubric. Whether the patient hears it, it's not given a sensation. Clucking sound in chest. We don't have a particular situation where a doctor can hear a clucking sound. I have never used it and have tried to understand the rubric myself, but clinically I can't use this clucking sound. Then coated sensation, as if we can't be, it's a sensation. Coldness, again, coldness like chilliness. Chilliness is a temporary phenomena. Coldness can be a long-term phenomena. Patient can always feel cold around the chest. It can be right side chest. It can be during the chill. It can be after drinking. Lots of things that have been given. So, but it does not signify a particular disease as such. A very, very big rubric it is, with lots of sub-rubrics. But generally, clinically, as far as it is concerned, we hardly have used this rubric at all. So, since it's 1 hour up and we have got lots of congestion, again, congestion needs to be discussed thoroughly, congestion, constriction and all. So, I think next time we would start taking congestion or hyperemia of chest.
Okay, great. So tune in next Wednesday at 11 a.m. if you want to continue listening to these great shows with Dr. Otto. And definitely give him a call. Contact him at homeocad.org or contact me at homeopathyworldcommunity @gmail.com. And tweet this out to your friends. Put it on your Facebook. Ask folks to share. This is an opportunity, totally free and open, that you don't want to miss, because look at all we're learning here. And I'm welcoming all of your questions. So
one more thing.
Go ahead.
Just Before closing on, since we are talking about coldness, I would particularly like to throw about one important feature which we have quite frequently seen in our practice. There's a subrubric coldness external, and it is written ranunculus bulbosus. Now, this feature is very, very commonly seen in herpes zoster. Herpes zoster, one of the favorite sites, is you have got chest. It affects one single dermatome, that is, starts from the spine, and the entire half of the chest or the whole of the chest in some patients could be covered. And initially what happens is you get vesicles or small boils filled with water. You get fever, and after 1 week or 1.5 weeks, the boils disappear, and then starts the pain, which is called as post-herpetic neuralgia, a very, very bad pain you have got. And in between, when the patient is having vesicles and post-herpetic neuralgia, because some vesicles rupture, some don't, and the patient person keeps, then there's a particular coldness which the patient complains of. And that's very specific of ranunculus bulbosus. And if you give this ranunculus bulbosus at that time, then you can actually avoid post-herpetic neuralgia. Certain pains in the human body are supposed to be very, very bad. Heart attack pain, obviously everyone knows. Pancreatitis pain, acute pancreatitis pain, extremely bad. Cholelithiasis, stone pain, extremely bad. Renal colic, stones, very bad. And the fifth one is this, post-herpetic neuralgia. And the patient would tell you, doctor, kill me, but please stop this pain. So before the pain, actual post-herpetic neuralgia starts, and there's a burning type of pain, that violent burning type, of, before that phase starts, there is a feeling of coldness when the patient complains, and it's an external coldness, and the drug of choice is ranunculus bulbosus. So even if you ignore the other rubrics, this rubric should not be included, because herpes zoster is quite a common condition, and this symptom can be used quite effectively. Thank you.
Oh, well, that's a really good tip that you're giving at the end. And is this the same as shingles? How would we?
Yeah, same. Shingles are herpes zoster. Same. Shingles, it's also called herpes zoster.
And that has become more prevalent as well.
Because the status has gone down. Whenever you get shingles, one thing is sure, that the person suffering from shingles means has got less of immunity. The immune status goes down, and it's only at that time when the chickenpox virus, it is also, the virus is the same. Chickenpox virus and shingles virus are the same. Herpes zoster is called varicella virus. It affects only in immunocompromised people. You need not be HIV positive for that, but definitely immune status goes down, and then you can have, and affected, you can keep on getting shingles day in and out, day out. But then when we are talking about coldness external in ranunculus bulbosus, it is actually coldness on the skin. And that needs to be just, you write it down if you want to remember. It's quite a very, very clinically viable rubric.
Okay, I'm going to highlight it in yellow on my in my book. And also, folks out there, we really, really appreciate you. We love to have our guests and listeners, and we depend upon you to talk about this and teach other people what you've learned here today. Okay, and also we have the archives of all the past shows. We also have upcoming tomorrow, Christina Chambreau, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, will be talking to us about taking care of your pets and pet behavior. Then following that, we have Alan Phillips with Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States. It goes for all around the world. You need to know how to approach these things legally and what groups to get involved with, because not only in America, we have the NVIC that you can join there, or we've had on a guest from Meryl Dory, who is in Australia. If you have somebody in India who would be a good guest, please let us know in regard to vaccinations.
Sure.
Yeah, and anywhere you are. So, and don't forget, we have our wonderful Health In show on Mondays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Yes, last Monday, we just did a whole set on migraines in women. And on this coming Monday, we're going to have Dr. Ajay Yadav, who is going to talk about migraines in men. And so tune into that. Thank you so much, and we're going to end today's show. And Dr. Adel, have a good evening, and peace to you.
Same to you, and have a lovely week ahead. Till we meet next Wednesday. Bye.
Great. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.